Blog Talk Radio.
This is going to be fun.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge for a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis from Sparkling Upper Westchester. And this is going to be so much fun. This is MJ Network in memory of my sister. And I am honored today to have Dr. Jeffrey Jacobson, board-certified plastic surgeon who specializes in hand and wrist surgery and peripheral nerve surgery. And I know he's good because he operated on my finger that used to trigger. Dr. Jacobson has held research positions in biomedical engineering, mechanical and aerospace engineering, and orthopedic biomechanics. In addition, he has authored and co-authored numerous articles and book chapters in several professional publications. Welcome, Dr. Jacobson, and we're going to talk about carpal tunnel syndrome. How are you today?
Good morning, Fran. I'm doing wonderfully.
I'm glad. I'm glad you are. So, what made you want to focus on carpal tunnel syndrome?
So, carpal tunnel syndrome is incredibly common, and it's something that really debilitates people that have it. It bothers people even more than they realize, and they don't know how much better they feel until all of a sudden it's gone. So, it's really satisfying to fix it for patients. It's also something that we've really come a long way in how we treat. We've gotten minimally invasive strategies. We have ways of doing it without having the patient even have to go to sleep. It just becomes such a satisfying thing for patients to have. So it makes it satisfying to treat.
Then how do they know you have it, though? What makes somebody, in other words, your hand hurts, your wrist hurts, or something part of you hurts, how do you know that you have it? And what would make you want to know, realize you got to go to the doctor and get rid of this thing?
So, for starters, one thing that people always think with carpal tunnel syndrome is it makes their hand or wrist hurt. And that's actually not usually the case. Almost always, carpal tunnel syndrome causes numbness. That numbness is more often than not focused in some combination of the thumb, the index finger, the middle finger, and sometimes the ring finger. That symptom alone, if you have that, that should cause you to go see a doctor.
That is really amazing. A lot of people just ignore it, I guess. I don't know. Why would they ignore it? Or just think it's just like I pulled something?
So it's unfortunately very common that people ignore it. When taking a history from a patient who comes in let's say they've seen their primary care doctor and their primary care doctor says, I think you might have carpal tunnel syndrome, so they send them over. When I'm asking them when it started, a lot of patients will say things like 10 years ago. And to me, that's tragic because they've had a symptom that's bothered them literally for a decade or more. I mean, I've had patients who have said up to 30 years. It's devastating to me that someone wouldn't just go get it fixed. And when those people have it fixed, those people are the people that it's the most striking because they know what it's like so much. They've lived with it every day. And then it just goes away and they feel, in a way, liberated. They also look better. They start sleeping. And that kind of brings you to the next point. Carpal tunnel syndrome is that numbness. But the sign that it's started to get much worse is when it starts waking people up at night. That's one of the big questions we always ask a patient. Does it wake you at night?
That is scary. I mean, I know my trigger finger woke me up every minute of the day. You just never know. But
It can really bother you. Use your hands for everything.
I know. And that's when you realize that when you tell them to get it done, they need to listen and get it done. Seriously. Because that's the only way
it's
that
so true.
Fix. I know. So what are the type of tests that you use in order to find out if somebody actually has this carpal tunnel or if it's not something else?
first thing we do is we get a history and a physical exam. And there's very little substitute for seeing someone that deals with carpal tunnel syndrome on a regular basis. And that's, you know, a hand surgeon is definitely going to be a good choice for that because we deal with it all day. And some neurologists deal with it as well. And those are sort of your two fields, I would say, are most expert in carpal tunnel syndrome. So just a discussion and an exam is enough to really point us in the right direction. The confirmatory test is a nerve conduction study, and that's usually done by a neurologist, but sometimes it's done by someone in physical medicine and rehabilitation. It's what's called an electrodiagnostic study. And if you think about it, if you don't feel well, you might take your temperature with a thermometer, and then you look at the temperature. If your temperature is 99 or 98, you're okay, and you go about it. If it's 104, you know something's wrong. The nerve test is kind of like taking the temperature of your nerve. You look at the numbers, and the numbers tell you how sick that nerve really is. There is research into other tests, but by and large, that's the gold standard now of doing that.
Wow, that is amazing. I mean, I remember a long time ago that one of my doctors, hand surgeon, said that I had carpal tunnel, but they never said the word surgery. They gave me these plaster braces to wear at night, and I had no idea. I don't know if that was the right way to do it. I don't even know if it was properly diagnosed. All I know is I was wearing these plaster braces at night so that my hands wouldn't hurt. And I found that kind of odd. Was that always the way that was treated with surgery, or was there other ways that people were treated?
So if it's very mild carpal tunnel, then what's called night bracing is first line treatment. So you may well have had the right treatment. It's, you know, without knowing how severe your symptoms sounded, it's hard to say. But if someone has very mild symptoms, we'll try them in a brace at night that keeps their wrist roughly neutral, roughly pointing straight.
Yeah.
And you wear it only at night, and this is one of the things that people do wrong sometimes. They figure if wearing it at night is good, then wearing it all the time is even better. And that's not true. That's actually, some doctors even make that mistake. You want it only at night, and then during the day you want to move just like normal. And if that makes all your symptoms go away, you probably do have carpal tunnel syndrome, and it's probably very mild. Night braces stop working, you definitely need a doctor. But if they, you know, if it just goes away and it never is, it's atypical, but you're lucky.
Mm.
That's the best you could hope for.
What kind of people, who gets that kind of problem? Everyone, who is at risk for this? And what are the risk factors for carpal tunnel? What are the reasons why people get it? I mean, it's so common that everyone, it's not anything usual. And now with the type of surgery, it's not that terrible to get it taken care of. So who is at risk for getting that? And what would cause them to get it?
So carpal tunnel syndrome, at its heart, is usually a mechanical problem. It's usually just the size of your wrist and the size of the things that are going through that carpal tunnel. So over time, as people age, we feel that, you know, the lining of the tendons thicken just a little bit. And since you have 9 tendons running in that tunnel and just one nerve, over time, as you get older, your wrist goes up. Now, since it's a mechanical problem usually, people who have smaller carpal tunnels are going to have a higher risk of it, which in this case means women more than men. And in fact, women get carpal tunnel approximately 3 times more commonly than men do. Age is about, you know, that's usually a good clue. Depending on where you read, it's either people from about 45 to 60 or 45 to 65 is sort of the sweet spot of who tends to get it. And then there are other risk factors. So things like obesity makes you much more likely to get it. Pregnancy can be involved. Pregnant women will get it and sometimes go away, but then, you know, it can come back later. It's sort of a warning shot. Some diseases like hypothyroidism, rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes. When you see those things, you can have them. But the most common underlying theme with carpal tunnel is you don't know. People just get it. So if you have none of those things, if you're a 71-year-old thin man with no other diseases and your hand goes numb, you very well could have carpal tunnel syndrome. It is It is not something that follows the textbook.
Would it be, who doctors, I mean, it sounds strange, that to add that to a physical, to say, you know, hand problems or something, since it is caused by so many things and it affects so many other things, would it be smart for them to just check to see that you don't have something like that?
You'd think that that would make a great deal of sense because it's so common, right? You have somewhere between 1 and 5% of the population getting carpal tunnel syndrome. That's huge. That's 1 in every 20 people up to walking around could have carpal tunnel syndrome. It's enormous. It's higher than almost any disease that we see commonly. But the thing about carpal tunnel syndrome is there's nothing you can look for. You just ask the question. So I always turn that around and say to a patient, if something is weird that's going on with your body, when you see your doctor, you have to tell your doctor. If you go into your physical and you say to your primary care doctor, you know, doc, my left hand goes numb every morning when I wake up, and it wakes me up at night. Your doctor is definitely going to do something about that. I mean, he may just refer you to someone, but he's going to put you on the path towards getting that taken care of.
Yeah,
but if you see your doctor and your doctor says, how you doing? And you say, I'm fine. Your doctor, you know, doctors are good, but they're not psychics. He's never going to know. Or she is never going to know.
To me, that's a warning sign to say, I don't believe you. Seriously. And sometimes sometimes you go for an exam, I won't say why, last week, and you find out, oh, really? I didn't know that. I didn't even know that was there. it's scary. So,
exactly.
What other
doctors try to keep you healthy.
Yeah, I hope so. Well, you do. Not everyone does, so let me tell you, they try. I mean, sometimes, you know, I find, seriously, that if something bothers me, you know me, I'm going to call right away. And yet you call, and then they get annoyed, and they say, well, you know, why are you calling? Because this is bothering me. Can I come and see you? Yeah, in 6 weeks from next Wednesday. I mean, not everybody gives appointments right away like your office does. It's different. So how do you deal with it when you know something's wrong and you can't get to see the right person? What do you do then? That's a scary, because that does happen.
One really good thing about carpal tunnel syndrome is it moves very slowly. So, you know, I said before that patients have had it for, you know, 10 years and things like that. So we never really – we tell patients that if that's what their diagnosis is, as much as we would love to be able to get everyone in immediately, and we do try, as you know, we really do try. That's a complaint that if you have it, it's something that you can sort of sit back. Now, you don't want to wait till next year or something like that, but if your doctor's office says, hey, listen, our next appointment's in 3 weeks, you're fine with carpal tunnel syndrome having 3 extra weeks. The real question is, are you sure it's carpal tunnel syndrome? So if you have sudden numbness in an arm, you could be having a stroke. So that's the kind of thing you do need to see somebody and tell someone, especially if it's really concerning or if it has some other problem, like your hand goes numb but you're also having trouble speaking or you're having headaches and it came on at the same time. Those could be very, very concerning. But if it's just carpal tunnel, and I say that with little air quotes, just carpal tunnel, but if that's all it is, you're okay taking a little bit of time and seeing the right doctor and getting it treated the right way. It's definitely worth it, as opposed to some of the things people offer out there that are more, shall we say, unproven.
After you have the surgery, we're going to talk about the different types of surgery that are out there for this type of surgery. Does it come back? Can carpal tunnel come back? Or the things to avoid after you have the surgery? Oh, well,
It can come back, but it's very uncommon. And if it does, it's usually not, you know, we tell the patient, it's not your fault. It's just bad luck. So about 2 to 3% of the time, it'll come back. That's just, you know, published data. People say, okay, so 97 to 98% of the time, it's gone for the rest of your life in that hand. So we tend to look at those numbers and say, those are good numbers. I'll take a disease you can cure 98% of the time. And if it does come back, you just have the surgery again. And the surgery is so small and so, you know, generally not a big deal, not very invasive, that if you have to have a surgery again, and it could be 20 years later, again, you've got this one under control. You're going to do well. It's not going to impact your life badly.
That's true. What kind of surgery is there? I know there's open release surgery, but how does that work? And what other kind of surgeries are there? Is there just one type, or does it depend on the person and what they have, the type of carpal tunnel?
So the approach that a surgeon's going to use is going to be specific to that surgeon. And, you know, for me, there are two main kinds. There's open and there's endoscopic. Those are your two most common ways to deal with this. And I do both, very commonly. And it really depends on what the patient has, what the symptoms are, and what the underlying, what we call comorbidities, the other conditions are. So if a patient has sort of run-of-the-mill, no other diseases, nothing else happened, it's sort of moderate carpal tunnel, which is where we like to catch it by, to me, that's someone I would offer an endoscopic carpal tunnel release, because you just have an easier recovery, much less to deal with afterwards, and you barely have a scar. It's so small. It's like a centimeter in size, you know, a 4/10 of an inch. It's itsy-bitsy. Whereas an open carpal tunnel release in that same patient is perfectly safe. It's perfectly good. It's still standard of care. It's just, I think there's a little bit better option in that patient. But in a patient that, say, broke their wrist a few years ago, has rheumatoid arthritis, has very severe disease, or has something else going on, it's an atypical case. You know, the patient's diagnosed and they're 22 years old. That's a weird case. For me, those are open procedures, because you may need to look around, you may need to see more, you may need to biopsy something, and you can't necessarily do that if you're being minimally invasive. So a lot of it is just knowing how to pick the patient.
We know you do. Are there any specific occupations that cause people to get this?
So another great question. That's probably one of the most common questions I get asked, specifically about typing. So typing, everyone thinks that they type and that's why they get carpal tunnel. And the answer is that's probably not true. So the amount of typing that one has to do to get carpal tunnel isn't a lot of typing. It's an unbelievable amount of typing. So if your job is being a court stenographer and you type for 8 hours every day at a rate of, 200 words a minute, yes, you may be getting carpal tunnel syndrome from that. That's possible. But if, like me, you type some, you write some, you do some other things, you go to meetings, you have a normal sort of white-collar job description that involves some typing, typing's probably not what did it for you. The jobs that do put you at higher risk for carpal tunnel are repetitive, extremely forceful jobs or things with high-intensity vibration. So, when I teach residents, one of the things I always say is, if your patient operates a jackhammer and has for many years, that one might have given them the carpal tunnel. If your patient delivers pizzas or something, picks the pizza up and puts it down, that's not the cause of carpal tunnel. Look for something else.
That is amazing. Because I type all day, you know that. I constantly type all day long.
Yes.
But I do stop in between. And I'm saying to myself, I don't want to get anything more than what I already have. And you just don't know.
Well, but knowing
you. I do type too much, probably.
Sure, but if you look at your risk factors, you type, but you're also female. You also have small risk. You also have... You take all of that together, and if you got carpal tunnel, which is certainly possible and common and happens to so many people, a lot of people will zero in on typing as if typing is the only reason they could have gotten it. Yeah. And in fact, one of my friends makes a joke. He says, patients come in and say that I type a lot, so I got carpal tunnel, and that's why my wrist hurts. And his joke is, he says, well, that's two things that are not true in the same sentence.
That is amazing. I blame it on the fact that I carry things that are too heavy. No, I don't think I have that. But I've been really, very good in ignoring my hands for the last 2 months, seriously. Except for the finger that you did, I just ignored the rest of them. Just told them they better behave and leave me alone. What can I say? So, I'm not even going to tell you which one's bothering me. carpal tunnel, is there a way to prevent it? In other words, if you feel like your wrist or something, are there ways to prevent it from happening? Or if you've got it, you're just stuck with it. That's it.
So if you get carpal tunnel syndrome, if that's what happens to you, you can't really make it go away most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, you can try the wrist bracing if it's very mild. If it's pregnancy-related,
yeah,
that's sort of an exception because pregnancy is
mm-hmm.
not a permanent condition, and once you're not pregnant again, it often goes away. But actually, in those patients, it often comes back many years later. So it's a sort of cure. But really, once you have carpal tunnel syndrome, the thing to do, you know, the people that sort of thrive and do the best will go get it treated properly, which is usually a very minor surgical procedure. And by minor, I mean I mean very minor. And then they go about their lives, and they, you know, 97 to 98% chance never have to deal with it for the rest of their life. It's just gone now. So
how long does the surgery
the
take?
Strategy.
How long does the surgery take, and exactly, you know, what does it entail?
So let's take an endoscopic carpal tunnel release to talk about, because that's very common in my hands, and that's your sort of run-of-the-mill carpal tunnel. So that surgery takes roughly about 10 minutes to do. You don't go to sleep. You get a numbing shot just like at the dentist. We sort of numb the area, and then you walk in, lay down. You lay down, you put your hand out, and we put up a curtain so patients don't have to see anything. They sit on their side of the curtain, usually chat with one of the nurses, and then we do the surgery. You don't feel anything more than a little bit of gentle pressure. You may feel your hand move a little, but there's no pain at
mm-hmm.
all. And then we take the curtain down. If it's an endoscopic carpal tunnel release, we don't even put a bandage on. We put all the little stitches inside, put a little dot of glue on the top, and that's the bandage. And the patient goes home. They can shower that night. They can use their hand normally, we say, for anything except heavy lifting. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you type like you do, you can go
mm-hmm.
home and you can just keep typing like it never happened. It's not bad. It hurts some that night when the numbing wears off and you wake up in the morning, it's a little sore, and then you're good to go. An endocarpal tunnel has actually an easier recovery, I think, than a trigger finger does. It's really a very minor
right.
recovery.
You're right. It does, because I'm still stretching my finger like a good girl. Seriously. And
just good to hear.
It still hurts. It still hurts. Once in a while it clicks, but it still hurts, yeah. But I've been stretching it a lot, and Jeff looks at me when I look, I'm in pain, and go, well, it hurts me. What can I say? I feel sorry for me. What can I tell you?
Well,
so what is the other kind of surgery,
finger,
the open-release surgery?
So an open-release surgery, again, there are slightly different ways. Some people do, you know, different varieties.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do longer incisions. But the quote, standard open, which when I do it open is what I do, the standard open.
Mm-hmm.
You have an incision in your palm that's about an inch and a half long, probably about an inch and a half. And, again, it takes about the same amount of time, all told. There's, again, people do it a little differently. For me, there's usually four stitches on the outside and a bandage. And I have people wear that bandage for a few days, and then they can take it off and shower and get the stitches wet. Some people don't let you get the stitches wet. Some people do it a little faster. It's all a little bit, you know, surgeon specific, but in the end, you take those stitches out, and it's long-term results are good with both. So if you're a surgeon, if you see a surgeon who tells you, hey, I want to do one or the other, it's your long-term results are going to be good with either approach. It's the quick recovery from an endoscopic that tends to be a nice touch, but you know, in the end, as long as you don't have carpal tunnel syndrome, that's what's most important.
So do they have to go to physical therapy like I did after this type of surgery?
So I virtually never send people to hand therapy after a carpal tunnel release because a finger is a small structure, so it really needs help moving. Whereas the carpal tunnel, you're really not operating around the tendons. They just happen to be nearby. You're really just making a little more room for them. So people just start to move, and they tend to come back at that first post-op visit saying, yeah, I feel fine. My hand is fine. It feels like I have a little bruise sometimes, but otherwise I'm moving. And then they usually tell me all the things that they're doing that I'll be a little afraid of. Like, they'll tell me about, you know, one guy told me he went and built a deck during his post-op period in the first 2 weeks, and I looked at him like he had two heads. I said, didn't we say nothing strenuous? He goes, it wasn't that strenuous. So people use their hands a lot after carpal tunnel.
That's amazing. So you don't really need life-changing things, but you, basically you shouldn't go up and lift a 20-pound bag either, or a 50-pound bag, or anything like that.
Exactly. I always tell people, just try and take it easy for the first few days.
It's not so easy to do that. What can I say? But, you know, what
it's
can I
not.
Say? A lot of people are like, you know, oh, if I don't get this done, I'm going to be late for this, or I'm going to get fired or something. You know, a lot of people don't understand. So are they allowed to do exercises, or is there medication that they take, you know, for the pain? I mean, me, Motrin, that's my standard. I won't take anything else. But what happens, I mean, do people need stronger medications in order to deal with the pain if it's really that bad?
You raise a great question about the going back to work. For the pain, I give people four pain pills, and they're usually designed for that night. And I would say some people take it, and some people, like you said, just take either Motrin or Tylenol or both. And that's usually very effective. But it's really for about one day. The question you asked about the going back to work and people being afraid of, you know, losing their jobs and things, that's a really common question that we get. And, you know, it obviously depends on what your job is. You know, if your job is operating a jackhammer, it's going to take you longer to go back to work than if you're, say, an accountant. But for someone who has a job that's not a high physical demand job, even if it's like a mild physical demand job, like they do something like they check out at a grocery store. For those patients, very specifically, I actually made sure that I have one, you know, I have some time to do surgeries on a Friday, and it's really for these exact patients. I've done this. They take part of Friday off to come get their surgery, and they go back to work on Monday. So it's like it never happened, and a lot of them never tell their boss if it's an endocarpal tunnel, if it's the endoscopic one. They literally never mention it to their boss. They just get it done. They feel better. They do okay. And I don't necessarily endorse not communicating with your employer. That's not a great idea. But some people feel so vulnerable, and they feel that their jobs are at risk. And that's a terrible problem to have. I feel very badly for those people. But what I've ended up doing is just offering those people, you know, an opportunity to have the surgery done Friday. And like I said, they just go back to work like no one knows. And they say they do fine. That's the funny part. They say, yeah, it's fine. I feel much better. So in that sense, it's a win.
That is true, because there are some people that are afraid to take off from their jobs, or there are some jobs that they feel that if I call in sick, that you have to call in sick because somebody has to cover for you, that they can't do it. So sometimes you just say, I don't feel well, I have a cold. Because, I mean, educators have to call in and say I'm sick. Nurses probably have to call in and say somebody has to cover for me. They're not going to lose their job, you don't think. But, that can happen where somebody could just actually say, I don't know when I can do the surgery because I can't be absent. I can't be this. And do some people just make excuses to put it off because they're just afraid?
People do that all the time. People are afraid of surgery. People are afraid of telling their employer. A lot of people, you know, like we said, pregnancy has something to do with it. So a lot of a lot of people that have it are women who have, brand new babies. And that represents a scheduling challenge. It's not a surgical challenge. It's just hard to fit in their life. Like you said, teachers, you know, I can tell you there's a few weeks in the year that I'll look at my surgical schedule. You know, I'll be like flipping through it and I'll see, well, that's weird. I have 5 surgeries booked 9 months from now. I'm like, oh, right, it's a school holiday, and everyone on that is a teacher. And they've booked up that exact week because they know they're going to be off and get it done. So you really do see lifestyle plays so into elective hand surgery, because you can't do your job without your hand. And, you know, you can sort of put it off. You do have some flexibility. But you don't want to put it off so much that the nerve dies. And that's the fear. If you wait too long, the nerve will just not function anymore, and you can have real permanent damage.
And then they would have to have more extensive surgery, right? It would have to be different.
The surgery can be a little different, but really once the nerve has died or the muscles, you know, are no longer working because they atrophy, right, it just doesn't come back. So, you know, or it comes back only partially. And that's, again, to me, that's a tragedy. When there's a when there's a surgery that can fix you in 10 minutes under local anesthesia, 97 to 98% of the time for the rest of your life, like you take no pain medication, when you've really got it down to that level of being minor, for someone to put it off long enough to get permanent damage that we can't fix is just, it's heartbreaking because this is your hand. This is your tool to interact with the world, and you've let it go for reasons that you didn't need to, for fear, for just worry.
I have another odd question. I'm sitting here. As I do my interviews, I write notes. And the one thing people worry about is coverage and insurance. I mean, Jeff just had cataract surgery. Thank God that went over okay. But you never know. What happens when somebody comes in and they want to have this done and they need to have it done and they don't have the coverage that they need? So what happens then?
So I've never seen, in my whole career, I've never seen anyone who has any kind of insurance, I mean really any insurance, not have coverage for carpal tunnel syndrome. It's one of those conditions that's just, you know, if you have insurance, it's going to cover it. It's so basic, and it's so relatively low cost for an insurance company that there really isn't even a barrier. If you have diagnosed carpal tunnel, I've never seen an insurer fight it. That said, insurance companies do sometimes throw weird barriers in front of patients.
Mm-hmm.
And if one does, you know, we send in the data and the notes. And again, I've never actually seen this one lost for a patient. If a patient has no insurance, then
yes, I'm saying,
you know, healthcare does have a cost. And so what we do is, you know, we figure out, you know, I work through a hospital, so we would figure out through the billing department, you know, what would be the out-of-pocket cost that a patient would pay if they paid the whole thing. And again, because it's minor surgery, it's not a huge undertaking. I would be surprised if someone guessed how much that surgery cost and guessed, you know, they thought it was going to be higher. It's usually going to be a lower number. You know, I used to be in private practice years ago, and we had things like this happen, and we would tell patients what the total bill was, and they would say, oh, that's actually not so bad.
Yeah, it is not so bad. But what happened, you know, like, he had his surgery after the new year, so I know that there's always a copay from all these insurance companies that if he didn't pay it by whatever, but I don't even know at this point. I didn't get anything from my surgeries, but he might get his from the cataract surgery. He may owe something. But that's an interesting point. I remember I was in your office the last time, and a lady came in, and they said when the girls were looking at that her insurance didn't cover it. But I noticed that they did everything possible to get the insurance company on the phone to see what they could do to help her. That was amazing because most offices won't do that. And I was totally impressed. I said, oh, my God, Barbara's sitting there, the other lady's sitting there, and the lady was on the phone in your office trying to get the insurance company to understand that she needed whatever she needed to have done, and they got it done. That's so rare, though.
Yeah.
Most offices would have just said,
what?
I mean, I know, I've been there, done that. We don't care. That's okay. Well, you don't have insurance, and that's too bad.
One thing I'm very, very blessed with is a very dedicated staff, and you know,
yeah.
I feel like we have to do everything we can for patients, but I've taken and very explicitly made it that these are our patients. We are here to help them. So that's one of the things that they do. I mean, my surgical coordinator has really moved mountains sometimes for patients. And it's, you know, the flip side is some of the things that we've seen denied by insurance companies verge on being unconscionable, but yet my office staff will argue and fight, and eventually, you know, they do their part, the insurance companies usually, and they cover the patient's care. You know, if you have no insurance of any kind, that's a problem we can't fix because the patient has either ended up that way or chosen in some cases to be that way. But Either way, it's sort of there's nothing there, so you can't do anything. But if a patient has an insurance company, if there's any hope that it will work, you know, like I said, we're very fortunate to have a staff that's willing to advocate so strongly for the patients, and it makes it better for patients. It makes it better for everybody, honestly.
I know, because I'm without Ashley Barber and Maddie Kenya, she's the best, and the rest of the staff, I mean, and Beth, you can't leave out Beth. I mean, she is probably the best office manager in the universe, seriously. You got to be lucky, because we walk into some offices like I did the other day, and you have to pray to God that while you're even standing there, that the person's going to see you, even though you know you have an appointment. So it's really lucky. And then the fact that sometimes you get lucky and you walk in on a Tuesday and get operated on a Wednesday is even better. What can I say? But that's amazing. Is there any research on any on carpal tunnel being done? Any specific resources or research that people could look into if they want to know more about it?
So like anything that's really common and happens to a lot of people, the studies abound on carpal tunnel. The quality of the studies is sort of runs the gamut. It represents the whole bell curve of scientific quality. The best resource that I would direct people towards, really for almost anything involving the hand, you know, first of all, this is not the best resource compared to what I'm about to say, but I have a webpage that has a good set of instructions and summaries, and that's very worthwhile for people. It's jacobsonmd.com. And there's a whole section on carpal tunnel surgery, on carpal tunnel syndrome. And again, because it's common, it's the kind of thing that I think patients would want to read. Another place you can always turn to for hand care is the American Society for Surgery of the Hand. That's a large professional organization where I and many, many other hand surgeons are members. It's really one of the premier organizations in the world for hand surgery. And they also have educational pamphlets and handouts, and you know, you're going to see a lot of common overlap between my site, the American Society for Surgery of the Hand, and probably any other reputable site. Which leads me to the next thing. Anything that's really common is going to attract the snake oil salesmen, the people that are trying to convince you to spend money on things that don't do stuff. So if you see things that are magnets and copper bracelets and weird creams or oils that you can rub on, that doesn't fix carpal tunnel. It just doesn't. And it's sad. Sometimes we see patients come in and they say they bought a $300 bracelet, and we shake our heads and we go, oh, that's so sad. Your whole copay for the surgery would have been less than that. You could have been fixed. But, you know, that's what happens. And people prey on people's fear for, you know, having what, you know, we call real medical care. People prey on that, and they offer alternatives that are, forget unproven, just totally ineffective, and they're out of pocket. And then patients are stuck with it. It's a bad situation. So be careful if you find a resource that sells something.
Yeah, and I know. I saw something this morning for IBS, and I'm saying, there's so much in that. Why would anybody want to drink that? I mean, there are so many other ways to deal with anything. So what are the hand issues should we be discussing or talking about? What other hand issues are very prevalent besides the fact that, you know, trigger finger or anything like that? And I hope I don't get another one on my left hand. But what other important things should people realize besides carpal tunnel? What other hand issues are very, very prevalent at this point that people get that are common?
Well, you know, if you round out the most common things that a hand surgeon sees, carpal tunnel is going to be one, trigger finger is going to be another. And then you get, I would say there's two other things to talk about, and one's obvious. One of them is trauma. People hurt their hands all the time. It's actually, if you look at emergency room data in the United States, it's the number one injured body part. So if you look at why people go to the ER, if they hurt something, the most common thing that they hurt is going to be their hand. So hand trauma is a big issue. And the other thing that I would say is a really big issue is arthritis. And if we drill down and, you know, try and limit it to one thing, thumb arthritis is a very big one. That's one I think that warrants the discussion. So if you look at your thumb, the part where your thumb meets your wrist, kind of all the way back, if you feel the bone and go down there, we call
mm-hmm.
that the basal joint, or technically it's called the CMC joint. People get arthritis there very commonly. It's more common in your non-dominant hand than your dominant hand by a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually pain when you grip or twist. So the common thing someone says, like if they open a jar, that's the worst thing they could do. It's worse when it's cold. It's worse
mm-hmm.
when you put pressure on it. And people don't often realize it, but heat makes it feel better. And if you ask someone who really has it, they tend to take long showers. Or my mentor used to say, when an old man starts doing the dishes and his wife can't figure out why, it's because he has
mm-hmm.
thumb arthritis and he likes soaking his hand. That was one of his lines. But that's a condition that, again, people live with for sometimes decades. And we can do a lot for that. It's really?
Really
one of those conditions that we can bring a lot of relief. You know, you hear about people getting their knees replaced or their hips
mm-hmm.
replaced or even their shoulders replaced. You don't really,
uh-huh.
you can replace, a hand surgeon can replace and reconstruct that joint. And we do it a lot. We do it very commonly.
And how is that done? Yeah, I know that sometimes opening a jaw with my right hand, I don't do it because of the trigger finger. I try to be nice to my finger. I don't want to hurt it. But my left hand, I know what you're saying in my thumb, and I don't know if it's arthritis or tendonitis, and I try to feel like I don't want to think about what it could be. So how do you treat? How do you get rid of that? What type of surgery is that? Is that one of those 10-minute things, I hope?
So it is a permanent thing, but interestingly enough, for thumb arthritis, the mainstay of treatment is non-surgical, and then only the people that need the surgery get the surgery. It's very different than carpal tunnel, where really just the definitive treatment is a quick, easy surgery, and then you're done. This is sort of more of a process. So the first thing that I do is I involve a hand therapist, and to me, this was an evolution. I didn't used to do that, and we would do all of the other things that I'll tell you about in a second, but I talked with one of the hand therapists, and I made a quip that I really wish people would just learn how to not aggravate their thumb, and if they did that, I bet a lot of people would just get better. And she said, what do you mean? I said, you know, like send people to thumb school. And I was making a joke, but that's actually what we did. She and I sat down, and we made up a little curriculum for what we now call thumb school. We've called it that for years. And I'll write a prescription for hand therapy, and at the top it actually says, you know, thumb school. And patients go very few times. They go 3 or 4 times total, you know, not like twice a week, for just quickly. And some of it's obvious, like how to open a jar, but some of it's not. Stretches, things to massage, sometimes a little brace, little devices you can get off of Amazon that just help you open a jar, different kinds of pens. And if you take all of those together and you sort of give your joint a rest and the proper exercise, a lot of people just get better right there, which is amazing if you think about
how
little they've invested. If that doesn't work, once someone has done thumb school, usually what we do is we give them a cortisone shot in the joint.
Ooh.
We use guidance. We use image guidance. So the needle, it's a tiny needle, and we can see it go in on the x-ray. So we literally just slide it in, give a quick shot, and pull it out. It's usually not that bad. And then that's kind of the mainstay of treatment until someone's bad enough that they need surgery. And when they have enough pain that it's really impacting their life and they have real arthritis on their x-ray, we replace and reconstruct that joint. And we do it with all their own tissue. You know, we don't put any metal in. We don't do anything that's foreign. And by doing that and reconstructing the joint, reconstructing all the ligaments and making it not lax anymore, we end up making it so that that joint doesn't hurt. We give a lot of relief. And those patients tend to be really happy because that pain can be really debilitating.
I had that procedure where they stuck a needle in my thumb on my left hand. I know exactly what it is. It's not that bad. It's like 4 minutes of ouch. I know. And I guess, I did. I had it. And it helped for a while. And then I was given a brace to wear for 6 weeks on my thumb. And I was actually, I was not even told to go to physical therapy. Not at all. That never came into it. And I asked that question, by the way, and that, to the person. I won't say who. And I said, well, shouldn't I go to physical therapy for my thumb? Or shouldn't I learn how to do some, use it? And the person never said a word about physical therapy, but I did have that procedure. So if somebody has that thing, how many times would you do that procedure? Or just, you can't do it. I mean, my thumb's not that bad, but what would happen if they needed it twice? Could you, would that be done twice?
You mean the cortisone shot?
Yeah, the cortisone in the thumb where you guide it. I know, I've had that. That was so much fun. The one that you did on my right hand is fine. It's perfect, what can I say? But the one on my left hand, I had a long time ago too, and I'm saying like, I had to, and then after the person did it, I had to wear a brace for 6 weeks. So is that the right? I don't even want to know if it came back. I don't even want to know anymore. But that's a serious issue. I know, thumb arthritis. I never thought about
so
that.
It's interesting the use of the hand therapist to teach, you know, that thumb school. That's that's something that we evolved, and really, it's not a textbook answer. That's something that. Just in listening to my patients over the course of many years, it really became obvious that tiny bit of teaching would be incredibly helpful. So I would say it's probably the norm or the most common to not involve hand therapy. But as I talk with my colleagues, you know, I have many friends who are hand surgeons, and when we go out to dinner, much to the chagrin of our spouses, we talk about hand surgery. And one of the things that, you know, we'll do when we're sitting at our, the nerdy hand surgery end of the table is we'll compare little tricks like that. So I can tell you some of my friends now do that as well. And, you know, maybe the textbook 10 years from now will say that that's what it is. But right now, it's very common. You go see a doctor and they'll give you a cortisone shot. And it's not wrong by any means. It's not wrong. But you know, I think empowering patients just a little bit more to help manage their own problem is it's just a way to do things a little bit better. And it's borne itself out. I think it's in this era of things being cost effective, in this era of, you know, looking for the best way to do the most satisfying care for a patient, it meets all of those criteria. And it also introduces them to hand therapy, which has a lot of value, because if you do have surgery, you will need hand therapy afterwards. And so you've already met your therapist. You're more comfortable with a therapist. You may meet a therapist and realize personality fit. It's not common. You know, it's not there. And if that happens, then you've sort of done it when you didn't have surgery. You're in a better position to be more of a self-advocate, if you will. And it just in so many ways, it's very valuable. And also, hand therapists are typically just wonderful people. They're very caring. They're very helpful. And involving them in hand care is not really it's sort of a no-brainer.
So when you go to hand therapy, because I did go to hand therapy, and I'm very bad because I like the fact that I had one-on-one attention, does it get difficult when they work with more than one person at one time? Because when I was sitting there, there was one person that had like five people, another that had three, another had four. And, of course, I was selfish. I wanted only one. And I was lucky because Megan is really great. Doesn't it get difficult sometimes
Megan
that
is
they have to have you? She's amazing.
Well, she's a wonderful therapist. She's one of the most talented therapists that I've known. I've been lucky to know many great therapists, and she's really wonderful. But, you know, one thing that in therapy, you know, a good therapist will know what the patient's needs are. So some patients need time to just do something repetitively, and some patients actually want to sort of struggle through something on their own and then get a little guidance and then work on it on their own and get a little guidance. And that's an approach that works for some people. Some people, you know, they need splinting. Some people just need them to massage scar tissue. It depends on what has happened to that patient, what surgery, you know, what injury. And also where they are in therapy. So, you know, some people will have a really bad injury. They'll be in therapy for a number of months. That patient on day one is going to be very different than that patient 2 or 3 months in. They're going to come in. They're going to know their exercises. And the therapist, in a lot of ways, is guiding. So So it depends, but for thumb school, it's usually one-on-one teaching because you're sitting down and you're asking all your questions and, they're showing you things. Sometimes they just take you over to a computer and like literally pull up pages for, on something like Amazon and say, here, this is $3. Order this for your pen. You know, this is a $4 device that helps you open a jar. Order one of these. And those little things will really help you, and they'll guide you so you get the right one. You don't do it in a, you don't buy the thing that won't help you.
What I really like is that she explained everything to me, and then she handed me the exercises to take home so that I could actually do them at home and see a picture of what I was doing, so if I did it wrong, I could yell at myself. Seriously. Because you know when you're doing it wrong. The other thing is that people have to know that when the therapist tells you to do something at home, do it. Don't say, I don't want to do it. Just do it and find the time to do it.
It's so true. They're so helpful, but you can only spend so much time with them, and you need to do your exercises at home. You bring up a good point about teaching, which is, doctors and, everyone who gets medical care knows this. Your time with a doctor is, it's limited somehow, whether it's, some doctors spend a lot of time, some doctors spend a little time, but even the ones that spend a lot of time, it's still not, like hours, and you don't see a doctor, twice a week but therapists you do. You get a lot more face-to-face time with your therapist sort of longitudinally over time. And therapists are in a unique position to do a lot of the teaching. So one thing I think that a good hand surgeon will do is guide you towards therapists that they know are both knowledgeable and effective at communicating with you and tailoring your treatment for you. And, you had the opportunity of working with a real master at that.
But yeah, I know.
Not everyone is going to fit. Not everyone is going to do that. So I think that's another responsibility that's incumbent on your doctor to sort of, from a high level, sort of put together that treatment plan. And then as a patient, it's incumbent on you to actually follow through with it. And when all those pieces mesh, you get the best result.
I know. And I'm really glad that you just did what you did, because everybody, a friend came in on a Tuesday and was operated on Wednesday, and you didn't give me a chance to postpone it again. But of which I'm so glad that I listened. What can I say? But I want to thank you so much.
You gotta know your patient.
Yeah, I know.
My pleasure.
You know this patient. What can I say? I knew immediately when you called Kenya, I was in trouble. What can I tell you? But I have to say that the people at Westchester outpatient, I mean, I have never met people that care as much as they did. And David and Jason made me feel so happy. And, of course, I have to tell everybody, I am wearing my sparkling sneakers, my sparkling brand-new red and burgundy lipstick, and I'm sparkling all over in my sparkling new leggings. Seriously. I am seriously sparkling. But I want to thank you so much. If you ever want to do another one and talk about something else, just let me know. I'm right there. And hopefully my ring finger on my left hand. I'm glad. Just let me know when and when you want to talk about what you want to talk about. And congratulations on March 3rd. I'm excited for you.
Thank you very much. It's going to be wonderful to welcome another pair of hands into the world.
Right, and I can't wait. I'd love to meet Evan. He's my kind of kid. He likes to have fun, and I need another person to be silly with. It's great. But thank you so much, everybody. Dr. Jacobson, thank you a million times. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Bye-bye.